The Unshackled Waves, episode 261.
Broadcasting from Melbourne, Australia, this is The Unshackled Waves with Tim Wills, brought to you by TheUnshackled.net.
Hello everyone, welcome to another special live episode of The Unshackled Waves, because there was another big story that broke today, and that was that the Supreme Court of Victoria, the state's highest court, they upheld Cardinal George Pell's conviction for assaulting two choir boys at St. Patrick's Cathedral in the 1990s. He was found guilty back in December of 2018, but it wasn't public until February 2019 when the prosecution decided to not go ahead with a second trial on a separate charge. Cardinal Pell and his team appealed to the Supreme Court of Victoria, and by a margin of 2-1, they dismissed the appeal, which means that Cardinal Pell, his sentence of 6 years remains with a non-parole period of 3 years and 8 months remains. His only avenue of appeal remaining is the High Court. Now, there is still a lot of community opinion divided, and so we're going to go through from now. Do we accept the verdict, or is there still some doubt? So I've got with me tonight the Unshackled's senior editor and devout Catholic, Damien Ferry. How are you?
I'm good, Tim.
Now, obviously today was hearing the appeal, the main reason that this conviction was so contentious is because it was based on the testimony of one of the choir boys alone, the other choir boy who was found guilty to be abused by Pell. He died in 2014 of a heroin overdose, and his family attribute his early death to the abuse of Pell, but he never said that Cardinal Pell was the one who abused him. And it was after it occurred in a unlocked room at St. Patrick's Cathedral on a Sunday after Mass, when the two choir boys, they snuck off to drink with the altar wine, and Cardinal Pell caught them and then got them to perform fellatio on him before he touched them. That's the account that the remaining victim gave. And there was a lot of... Now, this is what the Supreme Court, there were two documents released by the Supreme Court. There was the summary judgment, and then there was the full judgment. Now, I've only read the summary, because the actual full judgment, it is over 300 pages, and there's just not the time to read all of that in one day. But it was based on the testimony of this one remaining victim, and there was the evidence of the opportunity witnesses who said, based on the rituals of the Sunday Mass at St. Patrick's Cathedral, that it was impossible for Cardinal Pell to have committed this offence, given that normally he was outside greeting parishioners. But two Supreme Court justices, I'll bring up their names here. So there was Chief Justice Ferguson and Justice Maxwell. They decided to dismiss the appeal. And then there was Justice Weinberg, who dissented and who said that based on the evidence that he should have, Cardinal Pell should have been acquitted on all charges. So there is that fine division there, but as like there's been a lot of celebration on social media and outside the court today, as the law stands at the moment, you can call George Pell a pedophile and a child rapist. That's what the law says at the moment.
Yeah, that's correct. I mean, it really is a shame that such a decision was made due to the circumstances that was given. I mean, when you really look at this case and how it was conducted, we will not know whether this actual offence occurred or not. But the problem is that it wasn't proven beyond reasonable doubt. There's just no way that I've ever seen this in the past occur in which one testimony of a person saying that it happened without any evidence at all stood so highly and was able to convict someone of this crime, especially one that was committed over 20 years ago. I mean, it's quite remarkable that this decision was made today and that the appeal didn't actually work out in his favour.
Now, based on, because the one remaining victim, he has not been identified. He doesn't want to be identified. He said he's not seeking like fame or like any sort of monetary gain. He just wants justice to be done. So he doesn't want to be contacted by anybody made some sort of hero for bringing down Cardinal Pell, because whenever this story is reported, they always make out that he was the third most powerful person in the Vatican. He was in charge of finances. So his fall from grace has been the most spectacular for all of the Catholic priests who've been convicted of child sexual offences. So this is why there's a lot of international attention on it as well. And certainly a lot of people who are celebrating this upholding of his conviction, they're motivated by hatred of the Catholic Church because of this pedophile priest problem and the way that the Church has mishandled it. And, well, they also don't like George Pell as a person. And he has always, in my opinion, in his public appearances, come across as a very cold, unemotional, uncaring person. Like, I'll do a brief impersonation of him now. He's sort of like, "We are dealing with this terrible tragedy in the Church." Like, it almost sounds like a robot. Like, that he... And there's a lot of people who've dealt with him in privately who say that he's the same. And this was always the thing, that he was an incredibly unlikable person.
Yeah, I mean, not everybody has an uplifting, friendly personality. And I don't think that should be a reason as to why somebody should be charged with such a horrific crime. I do understand the point being that it turns a lot of people off and for instance, isn't classified, at least in modern times, to be cool and trendy and so forth. But I mean, given the circumstances also, I mean, the guy is 78 years old. I mean, your classic 78-year-old person down the street that you meet, I mean, many of them that old are like that. I mean, they are very you know, cold and dull and so forth. I mean, you do get bright personalities, so forth, for sure, of course. But, I mean, you have to understand also the kind of life that these people have gone through. I mean, these people have gone through wars. They've gone through horrific times during the era that they were in, you know. And because of that, a lot of people in that era and in that age bracket are very serious types in their personalities. There's a real push, like you mentioned here, that people have an expectation for priests or religious clergy to have that really, I guess, modern touch of, you know, uplifting excitement, maybe something that you get more in charismatic type of churches. But at the end of the day, we shouldn't really hold that to such a big we shouldn't really see that as such a big issue, you know. It really has to do with how these people conduct themselves and what they get up to, you know, if these people are guilty of these crimes or aren't they, and what evidence is there to suggest that this is the case. So we can't really go into how they are as when it comes to their personalities or their attitudes. I think that is irrelevant, really, because everybody is different. And we can't really, I mean, a lot of people are good at hiding their true character. So even the ones that are very friendly are sometimes the ones that are pedophiles, and the ones that are very serious aren't, and they're quite nice people. They're just very tough to break. So it's very difficult to judge it on character alone, because, like I said, sometimes it's the complete opposite in reverse.
Oh yeah, you can't convict somebody based on their personality alone. But the point I was making is that his cold demeanor, that's what made him unlikable to people who already don't like the Catholic Church, but people who see on TV, they've seen Cardinal Pell on, you know, television for years giving interviews, and have not liked him. And so that's why I don't think there's sort of this, I mean, a lot of, obviously people who are, because this is a political trial as well. Well, obviously it wasn't motivated by politics, but it was seen through the prism of politics, because Cardinal Pell in the Catholic Church, he was a staunch traditionalist. He opposed the Catholic Church embracing progressive doctrines, like one of them to remain solidly pro-life and against LGBT and other sexually promiscuous things. So yeah, he's definitely, even though he's number three in the Vatican, he definitely doesn't share the sort of same worldview as Pope Francis, who, well, he recently said that nationalist speeches in Europe currently remind him of Hitler in the 1930s, which is pretty disturbing.
Yeah, I mean, they're totally different characters, and especially in the church today, it is more uncommon to find types of people that are similar to George Pell, that are a little bit more on the conservative end of the spectrum, because the church has changed dramatically ever since the 60s. It's gone through such reformation. I mean, I've been seeing online when it comes to these sort of cases, you see a lot of progressives saying that the Catholic Church has to be changing and reforming to the 2019 standard. And my response to that is that they've really changed dramatically over the last 50 years. I mean, it's amazing if people really look back to how it used to be prior to the 60s to how it is now. It has made big, remarkable changes. And some people would say to the detriment that they have made those changes, but that's another debate altogether. But there have been a lot of changes made, a lot of progression in the church. I mean, I would, for the church to come out and you know, be pro-abortion or, you know, pro-LGBT, I mean, that would be really dramatic. I mean, it would be very hard for, I mean, Pope Francis really has, I mean, since he's been elected, and he's been in the job for about 7 years now, he's really even made further changes and really pushed these progressive lines. We've heard him speak on climate change and all of this sort of stuff. So he really has changed a lot too, in how people would view the church. But there is also a line that's to be drawn here. I mean, I just really can't see the church getting away with coming out as similar to a stance like the Uniting Church would have when it comes to abortion or LGBT rights. I mean, that would be something that would be even remarkable for these days, I'd say.
Yeah, like, I don't think that they'll ever embrace that either. I mean, the Catholic Church has been stuck very much to its doctrine that it's held over the past two millennia, but obviously a lot changed with Vatican II, which I know, Damien, you're a traditionalist Catholic, so you oppose Vatican II, which brought in a lot of changes.
Yeah, that's correct. I mean, that is a really big topic in itself. I mean, but in Vatican II, there was a lot of reformation, a lot of change, and a lot of people still to this day reject that. And funny enough, actually, it's a lot of the younger people that are coming out and turning to tradition versus the boomer generation that seem to be the ones that want rock concerts in churches, see? So the exact reverse of what people might think it is, it generally is that the more modern progressive types are the boomer generation, the older generation, that were the ones that went through that change and that really embraced it. And the young people looking at that just don't seem to embrace that ideal, that standard, and want to go to the history, to the originality of how it used to be. It definitely has gone through so much. Even in Pell's case, I mean, Pell, if you look at it, I mean, he isn't someone that rejected Vatican II or anything. So even to that standard, he isn't really a traditionalist as such. But he definitely is still conservative amongst the many that are out today. There's no question about that. I just really want a fair trial to come of this. You know, really for people to look at this. As I mean, a lot of people actually compared this to the Chamberlain case.
Yeah, I've seen, because there's a lot of Catholics on my friends list, and they've been posting that. And yeah, Lindy Chamberlain, she was found guilty of murdering her daughter Azaria at Ayers Rock in 1980, and she was she said at the time, and it's pretty much once her conviction was quashed, that the consensus is that it was taken by a dingo, and we just saw a dingo take a baby from Fraser Island last year, so it wasn't an absurd proposition. But yeah, there was a lot of dodgy evidence during her trial. The fact that what they claimed was blood in the car, it was highly unlikely to be actually blood. It could have been, I can't remember exactly, but it could have been a whole bunch of other things. But yeah, Lindy Chamberlain at the time, that went all the way to the High Court, and the High Court rejected the appeal, so it looked like she would be in jail for the rest of her life. But then, of course, new evidence came to light, and some of the evidence at the trial was dodgy as well. So, but yeah, as I said, I should also make the point that he was convicted by the second jury. That during the first jury, it was a hung jury. They couldn't come to a unanimous verdict, so they had retrial, and the second jury came to a unanimous decision that he was guilty. And then we had the sentences posed by Justice Kidd and the county court, and now we've got the Supreme Court, which is 2-1, which. It's interesting that in Victoria's highest court, there's only three justices. That's like sort of 2-1. That's sort of very, very narrow.
Mm. Yeah, you would expect more out of being such a high place there. I mean, he can still take it to the high court, and I'm sure he will. And it'll be interesting to see what decision they come to. I mean, you really have to look at it for what it is. I mean, regardless of what the case is, based on the evidence that was presented here, whether it be any case that had this particular evidence, it's very difficult to find somebody guilty based on that. I just can't see how.
But it happens more often than you think, that a person is convicted based on the testimony of another. Because we are live at the moment, and there is a comment here from Paula Edber, who says, "So you know more than two senior justices?" No, we don't know more than two senior justices. This is the thing, because the victim is anonymous. We didn't go through the trial. We didn't hear his testimony, which everybody who's spoken with him says was very compelling. And obviously the jury agreed, and the two Supreme Court justices agreed. So he must have been pretty convincing to them for them to convict Pell and uphold the conviction based on that testimony alone. And you have to remember with sort of these other high profile accusations, I mean, the thing that comes to mind is that Cassie Blasey Ford, who accused Supreme Court Justice Brett Kavanaugh of sexually assaulting her at a party back in the 80s. Now, she obviously got very famous off that, and now there's a book deal and that. She got to testify before Congress. She was a nobody before that came. She had a lot to gain from, well, it was Donald Trump's appointee. So she, of course, was believed by all of the people who believe Trump, say, a misogynist. So, yeah, she's gained quite a bit from this notoriety, as has every woman who's accused Trump or any public figure of sexual assault. The victim here he's gained nothing, absolutely gained nothing. I mean, nobody knows who he is. He's had to jump through very large hoops. I mean, you can't just go to the police and say, Cardinal Pell molested me and it's going to be taken seriously immediately, because he's such a high profile person with a lot of enemies that Victoria Police, they would have made sure, well, you'd hope they'd made sure that they'd done a thorough investigation of it.
So that's right. And I think that's why it's really important that in these cases that people report them as soon as they happen, or at least very close to happening, and don't leave it so long as they did. I understand the trauma involved in such a situation here, but when it comes to them being able to look at evidence, it's very much an easier situation if it is reported closer to the date. When you leave it there for over 20 years, and we've seen this in multiple cases now, especially with this whole Me Too movement that has come about, that people have decades later come out and said something, and many other have followed and come out. It comes to a situation there then that many people, and I'm not doubting that there are honest and truthful people out there that are genuine, but how many are not genuine and are really trying to, for whatever reason, gain money or fame or whatever it is that they're after? And I'm sure they are. I mean, it's proven a lot of times that people make false accusation claims, and a lot of them don't even get charged for that. Sometimes they do, but a lot of times they get off, you know, and I think that's very wrong, because the trauma then you put through an innocent person, that, you know, you really push them and making them guilty of something that they haven't even committed. And this is why people have to look at the evidence. They really do. I mean, anyone can come out and say somebody molested me, but you really have to understand the circumstances involved here. And when you really look at this case, and this is something that we've discussed, months ago when it first, you know, really gained steam and was coming out, but on the Pell case here, it was just a very, very difficult situation, because it happened in a room, and normally he wasn't supposed to be present in the room. He would be out with parishioners. He was wearing the robes, and normally he wouldn't be able to, in the short space of time that he had, be able to take all the robes off for that.
Well, that was a key point in the judgment today, because it was broadcast live, the judgment by the Supreme Court justices, and they addressed the robes that he was wearing. It has been argued by the defense that it was just impossible for him to maneuver those robes so that he could, you know, expose himself and commit the indecent acts on the boys. But the jury, they were taken to the cathedral. They got to feel the robes and even try them on, and so did the Supreme Court justices. And they all concluded that, yes, you could maneuver them in a way that you could perform a sexual act.
I think the timeline, though, this act was supposed to only have taken a couple of minutes, I think, and I mean, it would be very difficult, even at the age that those boys were, and they were teenagers, from what I remember reading, to be able to pin someone down. And this guy is a fair. I mean, back then he would have been 20 years younger, obviously. But
I see. So he's definitely a like, I've never met him, but he is a tall figure. I mean, back way in his youth, he was a ruckman for the Richmond Football Club, and of course. In Australian rules football, you're chosen to be the ruckman if you're really tall.
Yeah, that's correct. I mean, he is a big figure, but nevertheless, two teenage boys versus one guy. You have to think the scene in your head. You know, you really have to think it out and just play it as if it was a clip. And think, okay, how is this actually going to go? If it had to go in my mind, how would it actually occur for me to understand it, to actually think, okay, this is something that can definitely happen here? I mean, they would have still been able to put some sort of fight or struggle. I mean, they wouldn't have...
13-year-old choir boys who, like, he was the Archbishop of Melbourne at the time. This was in 1996. That was... Like, it was still coming to light that children could tell authorities that they'd been abused and they'd been believed. They were attendees at St. Kevin's School, which was in Toorak in Melbourne. And obviously they were in the choir because that would look good on their CV and their academic career. And, like, the Archbishop is the most powerful person in Melbourne. There is a power imbalance there, and 13-year-old boys go through puberty later, and so, well, I don't know what they looked like at the time, but, you know, they still would have had, you know, boys physiques. So, yes, a tall ruckman, as he was Pell, with his position of authority, yes, I don't see it as improbable that he could easily overpower them, especially when they were caught doing something that they shouldn't have, which was drinking altar wine. They'd been misbehaving, and so, well, Pell, like, in that situation, would have had something over them.
That's correct. I think another thing that the defence were also speaking about in reference to this was that particular room would normally be circulated by a certain amount of people, and that it would have been impossible for him to be alone with those two boys, especially since he would normally have been outside at the time after Mass, and even after Mass also that it is circulated by a number of parishioners that are putting things away in cupboards and so forth. So that was also another particular thing of defence that they were using also in that claim. There is a lot to it, obviously, and it's really difficult to comprehend, to imagine it. I mean, there is obviously a lot going for it, a lot going against it, and you really just have to see it for the evidence it is. I mean, a lot of people also were saying, how was it that nobody was able to either hear anything or see anything, given the time slot and how it all happened and how it all took place. There is a lot of inconsistencies there. I do understand what you were saying, and there is a lot that makes sense there. I just really think that hopefully we get the truth regardless of what actually happens in court, but the truth actually prevails here, and that if he is guilty, he's charged, and if he's not, he's not. I mean, that is what everybody wants. They just want an innocent man to be saved and a guilty man to be charged. And it's very difficult to make that call. Like I said, it's very difficult. I think that's what we really need to look at here. And for people to go online and just be cheering like you said at the start and say, yep, there he is, he's guilty, no reason to doubt the judgment of the court and stuff. I mean, the courts always get it wrong. They're not flawless, you know. I mean, there's a lot of people that are innocent of crimes and they get put away, and there's a lot of people that are guilty and they get off, you know. I mean, this is something that occurs quite often, so we can't really just trust the legal system flawlessly and say, yep, whatever judgment has occurred means that that is exactly what happened. It just doesn't work that way, because there is many times that they get it wrong.
Yeah, you are right that courts have got it wrong, and they've believed victims who've later been discovered to make the whole thing up. There was that famous woman in the UK. She claimed, I think, you know, dozens of men had raped her and got a lot of them convicted, and it was found to be false. And then there was the horrific situation recently where a man helped a woman with a car that had been broken down, and then for some reason she said during that time he sexually assaulted me, and he was found guilty of it. And it wasn't until I probably won't get all the facts right, but yeah, the CCTV footage eventually came out and exonerated him, and it was revealed she made it all up, and he lost his marriage and his job, and his life was ruined. Anyway, so yes, it's not out of the realm of possibility for alleged victims to have later found to make the whole thing up. And there's certainly a lot of skepticism of the believe all victims. I know the hashtag is believe all women, but it should be victims, because let's not remember that one of the main people brought down by Me Too was Kevin Spacey. I mean, his career was over, but the case, sexual assault case against him, fell apart because the alleged victim wouldn't, in the end, cooperate.
Yeah, exactly right. And another thing actually that is interesting to mention is that Cardinal Pell actually chose to come to Australia to clear his name when he was overseas, and it was something that he didn't have to do because of his position over in the Vatican there. So that obviously, I mean, someone that normally would be guilty of a crime would avoid at all costs to face a court, because they would know that, you know, they would definitely have no chance of being able to win it, or they would have a bit of a guilty conscience, so to speak. But that's one thing to note. A lot of people actually, this is another scenario that some people have mentioned to me before, but some people are actually saying that it's a conspiracy within the Vatican to have him gone because of his position in control of the finances of the Curia, and that he was getting a lot of business done in that position, and that he would be able to expose a lot of the false doings within the Vatican, a lot of the corruption, so to speak, that was taking place in the hierarchy. And because of that reason, a lot of people think that he was scapegoated and made to face these sort of convictions. Now, I'm not saying that it is definitely true or not, but it's something that some people do mention and believe, that there was a lot of people within the Vatican that didn't like him because of the work that he was doing in trying to get the finances and the money sorted out there, because it was a bit of a mess, and that he would have potentially found some misdoings within that, and it would have caused them some havoc.
Yeah, I've heard it's not widely known that he was, as the Vatican's treasurer or finance minister, he was exposing a lot of what's called the bling priests, who are using church funds to basically live the high life. So he was sort of doing quiet, diligent work, but he hasn't been defrocked at this stage. I mean, at his appeal today, he was still allowed to wear the Catholic priest's collar. So the Vatican, they haven't, you know, brutally cut him loose. And he still had the full resources of the Catholic Church to fight these charges. I mean, Robert Richter QC, I mean, he's a very high profile defense barrister who handled his trial. So there was, he certainly got a lot of resources, and the Catholic Church is known, often to its detriment, of sticking by their priests even when the evidence is overwhelming that they've committed horrific acts and been convicted of them.
Yeah. I guess in a way, I mean, it's very difficult for them. It's kind of like in the same position as if one of your kids, as a parent, was at least suspected of doing a particular crime or charged with a certain crime. There's a lot of parents out there that would never believe that their son or daughter could have been part of it. You know, they would always stick by them, you know, 100%. And I guess in a way, because people within the church don't have children, they kind of see their flock or their people underneath them as, you know, that kind of relationship, like as in how a parent would see a child. You know, they're like a family, and that's why they really stick by each other through these kind of difficult times. And I mean, when you compare this case, for instance, compared to a lot of the cases of other pedophilia charges within the church, this definitely has that not reasonable doubt kind of distinguished here. I mean, there's definitely you know, doubt in there, whereas there is many other cases that have already taken place that it was just very, very evident that these priests were doing the horrific crimes that they were, and they were charged and nobody even questioned them or even, you know, said, yeah, you know, there's a situation where there's corruption in the court cases, or there's something here that doesn't sound right. Like, it was just overwhelming that these people were definitely behind it. And in these cases here, I mean, I don't think anybody would come to their defense. But I think this case here, there's still that element of doubt in a lot of people's minds. I mean, you still have people like Andrew Bolt that are standing by him.
Yeah, Andrew Bolt was defiant tonight. He called the decision appalling, and that his faith in the justice system was broken. Now, he's been ridiculed all day on social media. He confirmed tonight that he'd received death threats, or he's received lots of death threats throughout his career. But I've noticed just people on social media who've been expressing skepticism about the verdict have been private message saying, like, you dirty pedo apologist, you know, bastard.
Yeah. I mean, that is the type of stuff that you hear. It is a shame, though, that you try and take a position that you personally feel could be the right one according to what you have researched and read, yet people will make those kind of claims of being apologists and, you know, say that you're just as bad as a pedophile themselves just because you think that there is elements of doubt there that don't really add up. And, I mean, it's just sad that you can't take that position, you know. I mean, I think Scott Morrison weighing into this and really, you know, getting involved, I think was just a shame. I don't really think he, even though he's the Prime Minister, I mean, there's still since the High Court can take a different ruling, I think it's still a little bit early to make such a judgment, even for the PM to come out and say, yep, okay, he should be defrocked like he has mentioned and so forth. I think until he outweighs all his resources, which he hasn't yet, I think that is a very early judgment to make, especially in that regard.
Well, we know that Scott Morrison, based on his performance as Prime Minister, even though he is very socially conservative personally and very religious, he's a Pentecostal, I should note, which is, of course, one of the sort of modern Christian variants, where Catholic, Anglican, uniting, you know, been around for centuries. So he comes from a different Christian sect, and yeah, he's wanted to be sort of the center of the broad church, and like bring together the sort of, well, not just different factions of the Liberal Party, but different factions of the community. I mean, let's remember that he was a vocal opponent of same-sex marriage when he was the treasurer, but now he's sort of being very sort of careful with his language on that issue, and I think he doesn't want to in his view, sort of make the mistake that, well, former Prime Minister John Howard did, who wrote that character reference for George Pell when he was being sentenced. And obviously, former Prime Minister Tony Abbott, he was very close to Cardinal Pell throughout his political career. And so Scott Morrison, I think he sort of sees those Liberal Prime Minister associations with Pell, and given his own role as sort of to unite the community, and the fact that Pell has now been found guilty by a jury and had that guilty verdict reaffirmed by Victoria's highest court. I mean, he's the Prime Minister. He can't believe in legal conspiracy theories. Otherwise, why is he, leading a nation which there is, alleged corruption in the legal system? Of course, as the Prime Minister, he's got to accept that. Otherwise, people are not going to accept his decrees as Prime Minister.
You do make a good point, I must say. But yeah, I understand that point. I really do. But I think that the PM has let a lot of people down, because I think people were expecting something that they didn't get. I mean, I personally knew that Scott Morrison wasn't a hardline conservative type that, the left, I guess, was making him out to be. I just knew that wasn't the case. But I think a lot of people still wanted to believe that that was what was happening, that he was a little bit more of a culture warrior and stuff. But like you said, he hasn't really gotten into those kind of debates. He hasn't even got it weighed into the New South Wales abortion bill, which was quite interesting because he comes from New South Wales. It would be something that you'd think he'd have an opinion on, but he hasn't actually come out and said anything. And the Prime Minister has a lot of sway here, so he's somebody that, he can definitely change a lot of minds on an issue, but he's chosen not to come out and try and, affect a particular hot topic like that. And that's a disappointment to me, I think.
Well, there is also the separation of powers as well between the executive and the judicial branch. Their independence is part of the Westminster system, and so it's very inappropriate for the executive to say no. They do from time to time criticize the judiciary. I know there was that famous when Michael Sukar, Greg Hunt, and I think it was Alan Tudge, they criticized, can't remember exactly, but they criticized a court decision, and then they got called before contempt of court. But that was in a more, I'd say, it was a politically charged case. But this is, the Pell case is politically charged, but it's also very sensitive as well. And so weighing up both of them, that's why Scott Morrison has taken the position that separation of powers must be respected.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, there is a lot of factors in play here, I think, and that's why it's a very difficult topic to discuss, because there's so much emotion involved, there's so many different sides to the story, a lot of people have particular positions that differ, and I think people have to be respectful in the way they debate this particular topic here, because at the end of the day, this case can have precedent in the future. Like I've said in the past about this, that if somebody is able to be convicted just based on one person's testimony, without a huge amount of evidence, so we're not talking, there was no video footage, there was no DNA, there wasn't any witnesses, and someone purely can come out and say, that person molested me, and they go to jail for it, that sets a huge precedent. Now, I'm not saying he's guilty, he's not guilty, I really don't know. But given the circumstances here, it is very difficult and very worrying to me that somebody in this case and the way that this has occurred can be just thrown to the dogs just based on the amount of evidence that there was, which was very little at all. And that is very worrying in the future, that this case will lead to many cases that will continue this kind of line of rationale. And I think it's very important in courts, in the system, that people are convicted based on a huge amount of evidence, that there is witnesses involved, that there is DNA that is used, there is footage of some sort that, you know, and of course not every circumstance allows for these things to happen. But these are the particular tools that are used normally in convicting somebody. It's very, very rare to have a conviction based on somebody just saying that somebody did something to them and that's it. And it is something that is more happening more often now in modern times. And even though, like I said, there might be a lot of honest people out there that are genuine, but at the same time, we just don't know. And because of that, there could be a lot of innocent people in future that get put away in prison, and that is very scary.
I rewatched the Four Corners episode that was released after the initial guilty verdict was made public. That was done by Louise Milligan, who she wrote the book Cardinal, about the rise and fall of George Pell, and interviewed one of the choir boys in that choir which the two victims belonged to, and he said that he noticed a difference in their behavior after the abuse occurred. And they interviewed the victim, who is now deceased, his parents, who said that after the abuse, like, he changed and he was a different person. That's when he started to use heroin. But they also brought up the case that didn't go to trial, that was eventually abandoned, and that was that George Pell, while at a public pool in Ballarat, was playing with the boys in the pool, that he repeatedly fondled them through their bathing suit. And the Four Corners episode, well, they interviewed the two men who'd alleged that, and I thought that was interesting that there wasn't enough evidence to bring that to trial, but you could still include it in a Four Corners episode after the fact.
Yeah, that's an interesting circumstance. I mean, I have heard about that that situation that you bring up about the pool, and nothing come of it in the end. Like you mentioned, there was people bringing it up, but then, yeah, nothing eventuated from it. So that is an interesting situation there, and we could only wonder why that is the case and nobody actually went forward with it. But that's what I mean, you know, like in cases like this happens quite often, that people are accused of things, and it's more of a modern phenomenon. I mean, it didn't happen very often back in the old days. People were a little bit more genuine in you know, and only accused people that really did something to them. But here it's very, very, times have changed, and obviously there is still genuine people out there, and I don't mean to class everybody as exactly the same here, but it would really be scary to even consider being a priest these days, wouldn't it, as an occupation? You just wouldn't want to do it.
I've heard stories from, like, devout Catholics who, like, were just been hanging out with priests in public places, and, like, people come up to them and, you know, label them pedos without any evidence. And yes, it can be denied that there's been horrific abuses of children by Catholic priests in the latter half of the 20th century, and it cannot be denied that the church has handled it appallingly. Like, obviously Ballarat, where George Pell was from, that was where a lot of the most horrific abuse took place. And when the Royal Commission into Institutionalized Child Sexual Abuse arrived there, it was like a horror show. And that's where Australia's most notorious pedophile priest, Gerard Ridsdale, was from. He was convicted in the early 90s, and of course Pell was criticised because he walked to court with Gerard Ridsdale, which he said he regrets now. Now, all of this that was going on in Ballarat, it's always been said, like, Pell, like, you know, how could you not know what was going on, like, all these priests moved and that. I just want to raise something that's quite interesting, because one of the sort of journalists who was doing a dance on the appeal being thrown out was Paul Bongiorno, who was the political reporter for Network 10 for many years. He's now semi-retired, writes for the Saturday paper, which is a far-left newspaper, and he's pretty open about his left-wing bias now. But back in the 70s, he was a Catholic priest, and he shared a house with Jared Ridsdale. And he said that, you know, I had no idea he was this horrible pedophile. And I believe Paul Bongiorno that, well, often, like, these pedophiles, they manage to keep a relatively secret what they do. But, you know, like, no one sort of, like, gone after Paul Bongiorno and said, how could you not know, you know, where were you? But, yeah, like, sort of with Pell, it's sort of like, well, how could you, you know, you shared a house with him, like, how could you not know? There's sort of a double standard, because Paul Bongiorno's like, well, he's changed completely from his priest days, given his politics now, but sort of there's no scrutiny on Paul Bongiorno, but that's always been used to tarnish Pell.
It has, definitely. It's very interesting that you mentioned that, actually, because, I mean, just to something that I was mentioning before, it's very difficult to judge who somebody is just by, you know, having general consensus with them, even being friends with someone. It doesn't mean that you actually know who they are. And a lot of people that would be pedophiles, I would think, are actually more friendly, more sort of like really upfront, come across as nice people. That's why someone like Pell, that is, you know, like you mentioned, very cold, very, you know, very dry personality, very, you know, typically those people aren't your type of pedophiles. The pedophiles are normally really, you know, friendly.
Well, yeah.
They try and hide their sort of dark.
Well, using Jared Ridsdale as an example, because I've watched a few stories about him, and yes, he was known as being overtly affectionate with children, just in his general behavior, which is how a lot of sort of this, like, how pedophiles begin. It's they begin with sort of like affection, and then they sort of like move in more. Like, that's how they sort of work.
Yeah, it happens quite often. Another issue, actually, I must say, I'm looking at the comments on the chat, and Zvadanek is actually on the ball with a lot of the things that, you know, there's a lot of great comments that he's making here. Actually, mentioning the case of Bill Shorten, that you know, a woman came up and accused him and nothing was done about that.
Yeah. So,
that's very interesting to compare Bill Shorten's case to how it is here.
And I know that it's a Liberal Catholic MP, state MP, posted tonight that it should be noted that Labor Party in Victoria for the past 20 years has been in office for 16, and so they've had power over most of the judicial appointments, and so sort of wanted his followers to know that fact.
Yeah, another actual thing that I was going to mention, and that would be something that is actually happening right now, and it seems like every state is going through this as the next kind of, how can I say, issue that progressives want to sort of change and rally on, and that would be the issue of the seal of confession. And I think that's important to mention this, because judging based on George Pell having lived with the other priests, for instance, now he might have known that there was something not right about a fellow priest, but if it was only said within the confines of the confessional, then it is a very different circumstance as to whether he was just chatting to the priest
yes,
in a very general sort of context, and you know, the priest was to say something, and then, you know, that would be a totally different Obviously, the way that Catholicism sees the seal of confession being a freedom of religion issue being very important in each state, it seems. I know Victoria, I think, is going through the debate at the moment in trying to remove that seal of confession. And there's a lot of controversy over that, and they're using these kind of pedophile cases to really rally in order to change that. But a lot of people have made the point, justfully, that if you were to make that law, that all you will get will be that pedophiles won't actually say anything at the confessional anyway, and nothing will occur that will change anything. Not only that, is that even if priests were to hear it, they just wouldn't report it, and there wouldn't be any evidence to say that they heard it in the first place. So really, it's, you know, there's no point in changing that, because it just won't help the situation. It won't really help catch pedophiles or anything based on those two reasons.
Well, it's based on the fact that every other profession, even like the medical profession, for example, even though there is doctor-patient confidentiality, like they have to report sexual abuse. And this is one of the areas where I think that, yes, the Catholic Church, they just have to accept the reality of 2019. I'm not sure these days who would confess to a priest that they've molested a child. I mean, like, to my way of thinking, like, if you think that you can just, like, go into the confessional and be forgiven for ruining a child's life through abusing them, like, and the priest says, you're forgiven, like, that's obscene to me. Like, no, like, you took an innocence from a child. You don't get to, you know, just have a priest say you're forgiven. No.
Yeah, well, I actually think there wouldn't be many people out there that would confess such, you know, grandeur things to priests. I think the things that are confessed are very minute, like really minor sort of, you know, oh, this particular person, you know, I cursed at him, or, you know, this person, I'm not treating them well, or so forth. Just really minute things. I think it'd be very rare that somebody would go into confessional and say, I raped someone, I killed someone. I mean, I don't think many people that have done such horrific crimes would, you know, care about going into a confessional and even have the balls to do so. And actually, in that context, I think it would be very difficult for someone to be doing something like that. I don't think it would be something that happened very often, that's for sure. I think it's mainly very minor things. But in all, I mean, the people that are really leading this charge, they're only using these cases as an excuse, and their goal really is just to further attack religion, because they just hate religion and they're using anything against it. Unfortunately, these kind of circumstances don't do the reputation of the church any good, and it's very sad when these situations come up because of that reason. And obviously, you know, it's not good that there are victims, genuine victims out there that are, you know, molested by priests and so forth. Another thing to note, though, is that there's actually a lot worse of cases within the education system in schools than there are in the churches.
Well, there's a whole bunch of other institutions that have been exposed for covering up child sexual abuse and Wolf. Like, we're just learning about the Jeffrey Epstein elite pedophile ring, and let's not remember the BBC. They covered up their biggest star, Jimmy Savile, who was sexually assaulting all these girls for years, and they're all told to shut up about it. And of course, Me Too in Hollywood, Harvey Weinstein got away with sexual assault, like, adults, but that was covered up for years as well. So sort of, it's an institutional problem that obviously religion has been one of the worst offenders, but we're learning it's happening in so many other institutions as well. But the reason why they're going after the confessional is because, well, the Catholic Church, its credibility in wanting to stamp out child sexual abuse is so low. And even to this day, there's still heaps of pastors who I just saw two stories recently about some pastors who've been arrested for child sexual abuse. There was even I couldn't believe this happened in 2019. There was a priest in New Jersey who he had been arrested because he with three of his parishioners, he'd claimed to get demons out of them. He had to suck the semen out of them, and so, well, basically performed a sex act on them. And like, that's 2019. That, where something like that is still happening.
Oh yeah, definitely. I mean, there's definitely a lot of that sort of stuff happening, very underground, very much in elite circles. That you hear. I mean, that's why we're hearing a lot of this Hollywood sort of exposed things happening the last couple of years. And there's so much in it that that's still covered up. And what will come of it? I mean, like, their big suspect all of a sudden has, you know, committed suicide with, you know, most, well, they say he was hanged, or in other words, you know, two bullets in the back of the head, sort of thing. I mean. This kind of thing happens all the time, that there was a position here where he was able to, well, most likely when pressed in court, was going to expose so many people. And then now, what's it led to? Nothing. Like, I mean, they're still saying that the court case is going to go ahead, but without Epstein here, I mean, what can come from it? I mean, the big sort of, you know, a person involved that was able to expose the higher powers at play here is all of a sudden, you know, conveniently gone. And this is how they work, and they get away with it because at the end of the day, power corrupts. I mean, all of these sort of child sex, pedophilia, and so forth that occurs is within powerful.
Positions of power,
because people feel that they're invincible and they can get away with doing whatever they want. Yeah. As soon as you get an element and you feel like you're powerful, all of a sudden your morality starts to decrease. You feel like, well, why do I have to play by the rules now? I can do this. I can, you know, live a life
and
do whatever I like. And this is how it is. But they feel the law doesn't apply to them. They can treat people like dirt, whether it be through pedophilia means or just in general, you know, talking down to people, treating them like trash. And this is what happens in elite circles. And I mean, you even see, I mean, even in regards to pedophilia, I mean, look at Biden. I mean, you know, look at touching up girls. I mean, you know, and this guy's running for president, yet, you know, he's allowed to run for president, and there's endless amount of video clips of him touching up, you know, kids, and nobody really, well, there is people on social media causing a stir, but at the end of the day, the media is nowhere to be seen, and he's still allowed to be there in the position that he's in. I mean, this is happening right in raw footage there in front of our eyes, you know?
Well, we've gone over an hour now, so we might wrap this up. As we've established, there's still the High Court option to appeal, but the way I see it is that two courts have now said that he's guilty, and we have to remember we weren't witness to the trial and all the evidence, and so we're just two commentators analyzing how we see it. You want to assume the best in our legal system, that given the highly political and sensitive nature of this case, that it's been handled properly and the right decision has been reached. But of course, the High Court is under federal jurisdiction, but we'll see what Pell ultimately decides, whether the High Court accepts his case. But he is currently, he has been found guilty by a jury of his peers, and as it stands, is a convicted pedophile, which is why the lefties on social media today have been shouting it all day, because, well, that's what the courts have found. But yeah, I do want the book closed on this one way or another. I do want a ultimate decision to be reached. And me personally, like what the High Court decides, I will accept that. It's whatever they decide.
Yeah, well, I mean, I really want a decision as well, and I just hope that it's the decision that is right. I mean, it's hard to say what is right and wrong in this because ultimately we weren't there at the time and we didn't witness it, whether it occurred or not, but we could only go with what we're personally thinking, judging on the research and evidence that's there, and we can make our own opinions of it. But I just really hope, like any case, that it is honest and truthful, and that it actually turns out that if the person's guilty, they're charged, and if they're innocent, they're let off. I mean, that's ultimately what I want. I don't want to be protecting criminals, regardless of who they are, and I don't want innocent people to be charged regardless of who they are as well. So that's ultimately what I want to see occur as a result, and hopefully we'll get some answers and they become the right thing for everybody.
Oh, thank you, Damien, for joining me tonight and offering your analysis. You've done a double shift tonight. You're on Detonation Live with Steel Archer earlier tonight, discussing the latest in Italian politics with their Prime Minister resigning and Matteo Silvani, the great populist deputy PM. He's in the ascendancy.
Yeah, that's going to be a very interesting scenario. And if people want to tune into that episode, more likely than not, yeah, go and tune into it and have a look and check it out. And it's quite very interesting what's happening in Italy, that's for sure. I mean, the whole government is basically, imagine the Liberal National Coalition just all of a sudden splitting, and that's what you're getting over in Italy anyway. So there's going to be fresh elections, it looks like, very soon, and hopefully we'll get a good result out of that. There's a lot of support for Salvini, obviously, even people in Australia that really support his policies, and hopefully he'll increase and get a better result next time. I really don't know how it's going to go down, but it really seems that anti-establishment politics is really in charge in a lot of European nations at the moment. It seems to not have ascended to Australia. Unfortunately, we're still really in the two Labor and Liberal sort of main parties, and even though there is support for miners, they're just not really getting ahead. But I really hope that changes soon, and that we ultimately get better parties and better politicians up over here in Australia as well.
And you can check out all of the other Detonation episodes on the Unshackled YouTube channel. Thank you to our live audience who stayed up very late tonight to watch and contribute to the live chat. Thank you for making it a lively discussion. And of course, as always, the Unshackled Waves, is you can watch it on replay on YouTube, and we're also on your favorite podcasting platform, The Uncuckables. Our joint production with the XYZ and the Rational Rise is back tomorrow night, live 8:30 p.m. Melbourne time, on its own dedicated YouTube channel. And of course, at the end of every show, I encourage you to follow us on Free Speech social media, gab.com/theunshackled, minds.com/the_unshackled, miwi.com/p/theunshackled, and also Telegram at t.me/theunshackled. And of course, it's vitally important that if you want us to keep producing our articles and offering our analysis videos and covering things out in Melbourne, make sure you support our work. You can go to patreon.com/theunshackled or paypal.me/theunshackled. There is also our premium membership option on our website, theunshackled.net/membership, and our web donation form at theunshackled.net/donate. We also have a subscribestar.com/theunshackled account, and also our online store, theunshackled.net/store. So once again, everyone, thank you so much for your company. Oh, I've got to play the outro music fine. So thank you once again, Damien, for joining me tonight, and we'll see you next show.
Thanks for having me, Tim.
Thanks for tuning in to The Unshackled Waves. Please visit theunshackledwaves.net for all the ways to subscribe and follow the show. Don't forget to pick up your free ebook at theunshackledbattlefield.net and keep checking out theunshackled.net for all the latest news and commentary.